Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all to Trisha's True Crime Radio. Yes, it is daylight savings time and I love it. Anything where I can get an extra hour of sleep makes me darn happy. Tonight, we welcome Ben Winslow from Fox 13. Ben has covered all the high-profile cases in Utah. He is an amazing mind and we'll be picking his brain tonight about the case we will be discussing. Also, somebody that I think is amazing, Kathy from courtchatter.com, and she has that wonderful blog. If you want to get caught up on the Martin McNeil trial or any of the big trials, Kathy covers them, and she does all the work for us. She basically puts it in such a readable format, and then we can read it and feel like we know everything. She's amazing. Kathy is with us. Also, Pink Patrice from Web Sleuth. She dared meet up with me. She was brave. She met up with me and we went to court together on Friday, and I'll be talking about that in just a little bit. And also later on, VL Pate will be online to talk to us about her blog, which is www.re-newsit.com. Now it's time, everyone, for the legal goo. Get ready to be gooed all over the place. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests, and of course, you know that. So the hosts and guests, it's not the fault of anybody on any forum. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from websleuth.com LLC and forumsforjustice.org. In other words, my darlings, if you get upset about something, don't blame anybody on any forum. You come to me. That's the Trisha and Trisha's True Crime Radio, and we'll make you happy once again. Tonight, we're going to be discussing the very, very disturbing case about... Oh, yeah, I did forget you, Michael, but I was going to bring you in a different way. But let me do you right now. My unofficial, official co-host, Michael in Minnesota, is here with us. Michael, hi.
Hi.
I'm sorry. I did forget you. I didn't. I was going to bring you in this creative way, and I forgot to tell you. So it looked like I forgot you, but I didn't. I could never forget you. You are too precious and too wonderful to me. Okay. Stand by here. We're going to get this thing going now. It's going to be – this is big-time radio here. We have like thousands in the chat room. Okay, well, that's a lie, but we have a few in the chat room. It's very good. Okay, here's the deal. We're going to be discussing the very disturbing case of the death of Michelle McNeil. Now, expert testimony on Friday said it was murder, and the state of Utah is now trying her husband, Martin McNeil, for that murder. Of course, Martin McNeil says he did not kill his wife. Now, I was fortunate enough to be a spectator Friday morning in the courthouse in Provo, Utah, and joining me was Web Sleuth member Pink Patrice. Pink is with us, and welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio. Pink Patrice, how are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Good. Well, I'm going to kind of just give a little behind-the-scenes happenings of what went on there. Now, have you ever had one of those days where nothing goes right? And now, the only good thing that really happened to me on Friday was I didn't have toilet paper on my shoe. And I, as far as I know, I didn't, but I probably did. But anyway, here's the deal. It was just kind of one of those weird days. I got a speeding ticket coming down the canyon, trying to hurry to meet Patrice. The highway patrol officer, I swear to you, and I'm not being facetious, look, 12. I asked him if Santa was going to bring him anything for Christmas, and he got really mad at me. Anyway, I got a ticket, and what can I say? Sorry, I've got a frog in my throat.
How fast were you going?
Well, I don't think
don't
that's important.
It, don't say it on the air.
I don't, that's not important to this story. I just think I was picked on because I had a red car. Anyway, okay, so we go to court. I meet up with Patrice. We go to court. The bailiff comes in, seeks me out and says, are those prescription sunglasses? Do you need to wear them in court? And, you know, my dog literally chewed up my other sunglasses, so I felt like such a loser because all I have are sunglasses that are prescription. And I said, yeah, I need to wear them. And he said, don't worry, I'll tell the judge so he won't get mad. I'm like, great, I'm already on the judge's radar now, including the Highway Patrol's radar. So, Patrice is sitting next to me, and I take a picture of the defendant and the attorney. And Patrice asked me, she says, is it okay to take pictures? And I said, yeah, as long as it's not the jury and as long as court's not in session. So she takes a picture and tweets it. I tweet mine. Sorry, frogs in my throat. I tweet mine. But I delete mine later because it was a stupid picture. But Patrice doesn't. Her Twitter account has this picture from the courtroom. Okay, we get up to go to break. Once again, I'm stopped by the bailiff. And he asked if I tweeted a picture. And I said no. And he asked the name of my Twitter account. And I told him. And then Patrice, he went to you. And what did he say?
And, well, that was my Twitter account. And I'm like, oh, no. And he's like, were you tweeting in court? And I was like, yes. He said, did you tweeted a picture? I'm like, yes. Well, that is not allowed. You did not read the rules. I thought I was going to be fined and kicked out of court. I was like scared to death. So he made me read the rules. He's like, you're not allowed back in the courtroom until you read the rules of the court or something like that. So, I mean, he's like right in my face, and he was trying to be really mean, but he wasn't like really mean looking. So, yeah, he just gave me those papers, and I just walked out and read it.
It was scary.
It wasn't even during court that I took the picture.
I want to know something. How are they able to know that you've tweeted a picture? I mean, how can they?
Okay,
I don't know.
I'll tell you.
Who's talking now?
Oh,
is it Patrice? Is this Patrice?
I am talking now.
Okay, Patrice.
I was using their wireless, the court's
and so
wireless,
they,
and so they...
Yep. So they can track it? Is that how it works? Kathy?
Yeah,
Court Chatter, is that true?
I think maybe the hashtags. I think somebody's monitoring the Martin McNeil hashtag. That would be my guess.
Yeah,
oh.
On Twitter. Yeah.
Oh.
And
Ben,
you cannot take any pictures in the courtroom, ladies.
Well,
there's
we know
a decorum order in place.
Oh, Ben Winslow, do you know if somebody is, obviously somebody's monitoring, have you ever heard that before?
Oh,
yes. I mean, in high-profile trials like this, I mean, people watch the hashtag, and it is technically a violation of the decorum order to do that, and the decorum order states down rules. It's also kind of one of the interesting things about this trial is if you get up and leave to go take a bathroom break or something, you're not allowed back in until the next break. Once you leave the courtroom, you've left the courtroom. It's in the rules. That's the thing that's posted at the door. The bailiffs ask everybody before court starts to read that over. It was actually the other day because of an interesting complication that's developed is a lot of people are watching the live stream while sitting in court watching the real court proceedings. They told people to not live stream because it was sucking up all the bandwidth in the courthouse.
Oh, wow. Welcome to the 21st century, Provo.
I was one of those guilty parties.
Yeah, same.
No, don't do that. Kathy from courtchatter.com, you can't do that. So what I felt bad, though, Patrice, was I told you it was okay. I did the same thing, but I erased my picture, you know, and I just left you out there to hang.
I did, too.
You know, yeah,
no, I deleted it right away.
Well, I deleted it before anybody discovered it. I tweeted it and went, well, that's a dumb picture, and I deleted it. And I feel bad because I left you out there to hang. I'm like, not me, and I just step away, and I push you up to him because I was already in trouble. I didn't want to get trouble for the third time that morning. But, Patrice, you were in court that day. Give us your general idea. It was Dr. Perper who came on. Now, if you watch True Crime at all, you will remember Dr. Perper from the Anna Nicole Smith trial. And I apologize. I'm not trying to be rude or insensitive, but you will remember him when I tell you this. He has a slanted head. His head kind of slants one way, and he was born like that. He came out of the birth canal like that, apparently, and he's got this weird slanted head, and that's how I describe it to people, and then everybody remembers him totally. He was a witness for the state, a paid expert witness, and he basically said, no, she drowned. And what was your impression, Patrice? You were there that day.
Oh, I just thought he was a nice man, and he gave really good, thoughtful explanations, and the defense did not like that. I know that. They kept telling him to be quiet and stop talking and just only answer the question. But I thought he was really thorough and really explained everything very well.
He was excellent. He was fabulous. Ben, let's go back to the beginning. Let's do a little bit of background here in case any of our listeners are not familiar. This Martin McNeil person, very charming, but when the layers are peeled away like an onion, it's very ugly inside. He has been to prison, if I'm not mistaken. Everything pretty much he says has been false. Can you give us a little bit of background on Martin McNeil? What is he like?
Well, he is both a doctor and a lawyer. By all accounts, a very intelligent man. The issue is, of course, is did he or did he not kill his wife? I mean, Michelle died. By at least what we've heard in evidence, and depending on which version you believe, she overdosed on painkillers and drowned in a bathtub. Now, whether or not that was by the hand of Martin McNeil or by herself, we don't really know. The defense is, of course, contesting that a homicide even took place. They're claiming that there was no homicide, that Martin McNeil was at work at the Utah State Developmental Center when this happened, and that he had nothing to do with it. And, of course, the state contending that this was a calculated plot to, kill his wife so that he could continue an affair with a woman named Gypsy Willis.
And Gypsy Willis is kind of almost the center of this, because Gypsy Willis is the reason the prosecution feels that McNeil murdered his wife. Now, she's a piece of work. Let's go to Kathy.
She's the motive.
Oh, exactly. And, well, Ben, let's ask you this question, then we're going to go to Kathy at courtchatter.com. What did she say on the stand? She's just a total piece of work. She's been in prison, too, for forgery. Is that correct?
That is correct, and she struck a plea deal for her testimony. So what she said on the stand, I mean, you could arguably say was not a whole lot, because, she claimed she knew nothing about the death of Michelle McNeil. She, at least on the witness stand, that's what she claimed. She testified about her relationship with Martin McNeil, that she says that, started on the Internet and then kind of progressed from there. And then, within a few weeks after Michelle's death, she's been moved into the family home as the nanny, we should point out.
That is so appalling. And I just want to point out one thing, and then we're going to go to Michael in Minnesota. He has a question. Some of the things that I've read about Scott McNeil, all of them just rub me the wrong way. Not Scott McNeil, excuse me, Martin McNeil, rub me the wrong way. And here's one of them. It was the day of his wife's funeral, and he's there at the after gathering. And according to someone that was standing next to him, he was smiling and joking, and he was saying things like he's going to have to get used to living the life of the bachelor and hanging out with buddies and golfing. That's a rotten thing to say. I mean, it was like he was just treating this so lightly, like it was no big deal that his wife was found floating in the bathtub and is dead. And again, that just goes to show, I believe, his consciousness of guilt, in my opinion. Michael in Minnesota, you have a question.
Well, I wanted to speak to the comment that was made about him being so intelligent, for he's a doctor and an attorney or a lawyer. But he falsified his previous school records to even gain access to medical school. So I guess that's a brilliance in a different sort of way. But when you fraudulently alter your transcripts in order to gain access to college, doesn't that negate then the following or the pursuant diplomas or doctorates or whatever that would follow from the fraudulent transcripts?
Ben
and
Winslow,
I also want
know?
To say, I was wondering about the, they must have been listening to our show, Tricia, because last week, if you recall, Beth was talking about how in that plea deal, she didn't think Gypsy was living up to her end of the deal because she was really not being very forthwith. And then come Monday, the very first thing the prosecutors asked was if they could treat Gypsy as a hostile witness, and the judge granted it because she was so non-forthcoming.
But it wasn't because she was necessarily being a lack of forthcoming. I mean, they did say that she was apparently protecting Martin McNeil, but it was just so that for the purposes of them being able to ask leading questions in order to elicit certain answers without having to lay foundation, which may have taken hours longer to do. It may have been more just for judicial economy.
So that's why. And let me ask you about hostile witness. I mean, I've seen that on a million TV shows. Ben, explain
where they
exactly
yell at
what
the
that
person.
Means. Yeah, what does that? Is
it's
that where
it's
they get
like
mad
that.
At?
It basically, when you're asking for permission to treat someone as a hostile witness, it is largely because they are saying that this person, while cooperating, perhaps, let's just take in this instance, they may be cooperating with the prosecution, but they're barely doing that. And why? They have their own reasons. When you ask someone to treat, when you ask the judge for permission to treat someone as a hostile witness, it allows you to ask these leading questions, questions to which you already know the answers, but you don't have to go through the process necessarily of laying foundation. What we've seen a lot of in this trial, particularly with the expert witnesses, is exhausting amounts of foundation laying. Mm-hmm. Where were you when this happened? What, you know, were you doing? What time was it? What day? You can skip a lot of that stuff and just go straight to asking the questions of, you know, so as a result of this, what did you hear? What did he tell you? That kind of thing. It just allows you to skip a lot of steps. It's not necessarily an adversarial thing, although, it's, you know, by its nature, hostile witness is. But, you know, for this purpose, it allows prosecutors to just kind of skip a couple of steps and move right to the meat, what they want the jury to hear.
Understood. Well, I'm glad. Now I've got that straightened out. So, and Ben Winslow, one more question. Doesn't that negate his license as a doctor if he falsified his records going into school?
I think a lot of things, you know, given prior convictions, may negate his, you know, diplomas or his licensure. You know, the bottom line is, though, is, you know, whether or not he did or did not falsify these documents, he was a practicing physician. You know, he had a job. He was gainfully employed as such, you know, right up until his arrest.
Well, and do we know, Kathy from Court Chatter, have you ever heard of any complaints against him as a doctor?
Well, yes. There's a lot of stuff out there. First of all, he's not a doctor currently because as part of his conviction on the fraud charges, he had to surrender his medical license.
Mm-hmm.
So that document is on my page, too. So he's not a doctor as we speak. But there are lots of allegations out there of sexual abuse as his role as a physician.
Whoa,
and
really?
This there's so many webs in this, Tricia. There's so many offshoots and twists and turns in this case that really isn't this actual case, but having to do with Martin McNeil, that it is mind-blowing. You have to write about it and write about it and write about it and do 100 different stories because there's so many different offshoots of it. But since the daughters and Michelle's sister have, you know, for the years with him not getting arrested, they really went on a crusade to get him arrested, and they started a website, and when they started doing that, some women started coming forward saying that he'd either been sexually inappropriate, downright rape, molesting, all as a doctor.
Oh, that is just disgusting.
And his daughter Alexis he's been charged with, or she's alleged that there's been two times after her mother's death that her father inappropriately touched her. And there's going to be some hearings on that.
Michael in Minnesota, you have a question.
Yes, I do. How do you both feel as the trial has progressed now for its 2 weeks? Do you think that, I'm thinking specifically about the daughter so far that we've heard from, and I think that's probably going to be it for the daughter's testimony, unless they're recalled by the defense for some reason. But did you think they were effective, and how is the jury, you're able to watch the jury, did they seem sympathetic to the, I did read, Kathy, in your blog post that they really didn't seem to appreciate the cross of Alexis, from what you were gathering. They weren't taking notes.
Did anybody appreciate the cross, Kathy?
Yeah, right, exactly. Nobody appreciated that cross, and it was, as a matter of fact, the judge had to let the jury take a stretch break. He said he made them get up. He had his bailiff go get them all bottled waters because there was yawning, stretching, shifting, looking around all during Alexis's cross, and this is a jury that has been very attentive, that has taken lots of notes, really involved until that time. That's the first time I saw them just be disinterested, by
and
all
so
accounts.
Let me ask you, what was the problem with the cross of Alexis on
he kept,
the cross?
He kept trying to catch her in things that, in real, reality has nothing to do with this case, but that she put down on her medical school application that she was a nanny for her sister Rachel. But you weren't really a nanny. Rachel doesn't have any children, right? And so was trying to, you know, muddy up her credibility. But really, mm-hmm. he did a poor job of that. And he didn't get – Alexis held her own on anything that he could – I really felt like she was just sound. She held her own. He couldn't get her anything, so he kept just ad nauseum going at things that it was just too much. It was like, okay, just move on, because she's not going to give you what you want, so you just need to move on.
And he wouldn't, apparently, and that was what was making
it
the jury go into a coma. Oh,
it was.
Just...
It was.
Let's back up a little bit. You have this happy couple married in the late 70s, and it seems very successful. And all of a sudden, his 30 years later, he's pushing Michelle, his wife, to get plastic surgery. I believe it was a facelift and such. But during those years of marriage, he had affairs constantly, correct? Is that right, Ben Winslow?
Well, we know of at least one other with Anna Walthall, who testified that she had an affair with him back in 2005. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we know of at least that one. One other, because she was one of the witnesses against him for the prosecution.
And so what is it? So that, okay, let's fast forward again to right before the surgery. If you believe the prosecution, he was planning this so he could kill his wife, give her an overdose, and just look, make it look like natural causes due to whatever the operation was. And it's because of Gypsy Willis. Gypsy Willis seemed to have a hold on him that no other woman did. Is the prosecution alleging that Gypsy may have known that this was going to happen, Ben Winslow, and then we'll go to Kathy.
Well, if she did, she certainly didn't say on the witness stand, despite repeated questions by both the prosecution and the defense. I mean, in preliminary hearing testimony, there was a lot of one of her roommates testified, suggesting that she may have known or may have, you know, been complaining about Mrs. McNeil being in the picture. But that hasn't come out at trial at all, so the jury isn't necessarily privy to some of the inferences or the allegations that were there. At this point, again, Gypsy Willis, you know, based upon her testimony alone, she insists that she didn't know what happened with Michelle, just knew that she had died, and then she, Martin proposed to her in this big, elaborate way at a Wyoming restaurant, and, you know, then she moved in, kind of held herself out as Jillian McNeil at some point there, and, that's kind of where we got caught up to speed in the trial with that.
Exactly. And Kathy from CourtChatter.com, she came in, Gypsy came in as, quote-unquote, the nanny, you know, shortly after the funeral, and it was this big, huge party where he went down on one knee and that whole thing, and Gypsy's mom was thrilled that she was going to marry a doctor and lawyer, and so there was all this happiness around it. She moves in, and she basically ignored the children, right?
That's the testimony from the children. The testimony from the children, Sabrina McNeil was my favorite line, maybe of the trial, when she was asked about Gypsy's nannying skills, and she said she made spaghetti once.
Once.
Yeah. And that was it.
And that was kind of the general theme of all the daughters about her, what she did for nannying, which was next to nothing.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is that even in Gypsy's own testimony, and I don't know how much the jury's catching that or in the end, I don't know what it really matters, but she said she was in nursing school, she was going to school, and she was so incredibly busy that she wasn't around a lot. So how can she be the nanny if she's so incredibly busy and she's not around very much?
But Gypsy
exactly.
insisted she was, and that she did take the kids to school. She did all of these mm-hmm. things. She worked hard. She took care of those kids.
I want to follow up on Michael's question. We got off topic there, and I don't think we really answered it. So far, how has the case played out? Does it look good for the defense? Does it look good for the prosecution? Ben Winslow from Fox 13, go first.
Well, I think that, it's still anyone's game right now. You know, the defense has done a pretty good job based upon observation in planting that reasonable doubt. The prosecution admittedly has had a very difficult case from the very beginning. This is a case that it is not open and shut, not easily proven that, you know, Martin McNeil did this. And, the prosecution has acknowledged they have a tough case ahead of them, a tough case to prove, but they wouldn't have taken it to trial if they didn't believe they could. The defense, though, up until recent days, has been really hammering at a lot of inconsistencies in testimony, a lot of issues with memory. Did things really happen this way, or is there another explanation for all of this? They really have. However, in recent days, the state has really put on some very solid witnesses whose testimony, at least on cross, has been pretty irrefutable. It's hard to speak to the mind of a juror what they're thinking, but based upon their behavior, you know, they've, at least until recently, they seem to, kind of be taking it all in. You know, there have been a couple of times with the defense during cross where they really seem to zone out, especially as defense attorneys really try to hammer on these inconsistencies in testimonies, these contradictions in prior interviews with police and at preliminary hearings and other hearings versus what they're saying at trial. You know, and of course, what will be interesting is what happens next when the defense, you know, puts on their case, you know, who they're going to call that can maybe refute some of this testimony, and if Dr. McNeil takes the stand himself.
And Kathy from CourtChatter.com, what is your opinion of how it's going for each side right now?
Well, I think before Alexis, going horribly for the state, they just don't have anything. Like Ben said, this case is just nothing but circumstantial and even almost weak circumstantial. They don't have him doing anything to her. So I think Alexis brought the state to life a little bit. I think she was very believable. And then Dr. Perper, if they will hang their hats on Dr. Perper, then she was drowned, and really he's the only one that's going to drown her. But because they've got competing medical examiners on their own side, not even the defense's yet, it's a problem. I've said all along that I don't know that the jury can come back with guilty. The jury doesn't know what we know. That's why they're the jury. They got chosen because they don't know everything we know. So they only know what has come out in court. And they may hate the guy. They may think he's a louse. They may think he's got these mistresses and he's horrible to his children. And at the end, they sit around that table and say, can we put him away for the rest of his life? Because we know beyond a reasonable doubt that he did this. I'm not convinced of that.
I kind of agree with you, Kathy. I'm not sure that the jury will be able to find him guilty. Doesn't mean he isn't guilty, but, again, they look at things differently than we do, and it's really hard when you get in that jury room and you have a man's life in your hands. You take it very seriously, and you would rather err on the side of caution than on the side of finding him guilty if you're really not sure. And I think it worries me that he's going to be found not guilty. Michael, your question, please.
Well, a statement, first of all, especially when the jury is not allowed to hear all of the evidence that is available to them because it's too prejudicial. There's so much about this man to hate that it's just astounding that the jury can't hear what we all know to really form a good opinion. But like Beth said, you don't want him convicted just because he's such a louse. They've actually got to prove this case. But I really, it bothers me in every trial I watch, all of the evidence that is not admitted. I had read somewhere where Gypsy is estranged from her mother and has been since 2007. And I'm wondering if either Kathy or Ben, I don't know if I read that, Kathy, on your blog, which is my favorite go-to place for summations of trials. I absolutely think you do a wonderful job of retelling an entire day's testimony succinctly, and you include jury questions. It's just the best to read what happened that day in court, so I thank you for that. But anyway, do either of you know about this estrangement between Gypsy and her mother?
Yes, from her family.
Okay, Kathy, go first.
I'm sorry. Yes, her mother and father both said that they have not spoken to her since 2008. I saw an interview with them after they were released from their subpoena, and so that's the only reason I really know that. And what they had said was They were disappointed in her. They hope that at some point she can turn her life around so she can make a difference in this world. And that's about all they had to say. I found this also interesting, though. What they did say is that with every man she'd ever had in her life, she became obsessed with him. And so Gypsy's mom said in her interview that she said this in her testimony as well, but she acted differently. She acted carefully was the word she used, carefully around Martin. When Gypsy's mom saw her around Martin, she was acting very carefully about what she would say and what she would do. But yes, the family doesn't have anything to do with her family.
And Ben, what is your thoughts on that?
Her mother had testified that she hadn't spoken to her since 2008. It was quite interesting. There was one moment that kind of stood out to me in court. Just looking at the proceedings with her mother on the stand, they put a photo of Gypsy there, and there was a little bit of a lull in the testimony there, and we watched as her mother took the photo and basically turned it over. It was just kind
really?
Of interesting. Yeah.
Well, so do we know what happened between mother and daughter that caused this canyon of resentment, apparently?
I have no idea. I mean, I just, one could presume a lot of things, but, really, really no idea. I guess that we'd just have to ask, her mother and maybe Gypsy herself.
Yeah, because there's something really big going on there, because at the time, she was very happy that her daughter was involved with a lawyer doctor, but apparently it seems that mother and daughter are no longer speaking. Now, didn't they testify, and I'm going to generalize here, that Gypsy was like just not a real good person or that she was a liar? Didn't they have some really negative things to say about her?
Well, let me say that. Not really on some testimony, but they had done an interview during these years leading up to the trial where they had stated, I think it was, I'm looking at your chat box right now. Ashton says it was on the 2020 interview, that the family says she's a sociopath, that she had beat her mom one time, and it had left marks, and they actually had a picture of that they showed. Her sister talked about how calculating she was, and I think I put some quotes of that on one of my blogs. And then there was talk, and I don't know that this came right from their family, because I can't quote it verbatim, but something about her harming animals. I mean, what the thing else also that people, a lot of people don't know is Gypsy had a child and didn't want to take care of that child when she was about two, and so her parents adopted and is raising that child.
Oh, I did not know that. That's terrible.
Yeah.
Spawn of Satan.
Yeah, no kidding, boy. Ben, you've been in Utah a long time. You've covered the big cases. You've covered the ones that weren't national, but you've been in court a lot. Since this is a circumstantial case, and with the feeling, we've seen Casey Anthony get off, Robert Blake get off from things that we all know that they did something, but they can't prove it because of the evidence. In this case, don't you think, and you touched on it a little bit there, but I want to expound on it some more, don't you think it's going to be extremely difficult for the prosecution to get an actual guilty verdict?
I think that really it rests in the hands of the 11 people who are on the jury right now, and that's the thing, regardless of what people may or may not think, whether he's guilty or not, it's them who decide. I mean, that's the whole point of the court of law and why the system we have is set up to begin with, is that, they get to decide, not the court of public opinion. And so it's really going to be up to them. And the prosecution, yes, they have a difficult case. But there's a reason they have the burden of proof. And the defense is trying to show that reasonable doubt that you can the jury convict beyond a reasonable doubt? Mind you, we're not even through the prosecution's case yet. We still have more witnesses to go through. Then the defense puts on their case, and it's going to be very interesting to see what the defense puts on. I think that that will be very interesting to see if they can put that reasonable doubt in there or offer an alternative explanation. They have put in notice that they're going to offer the alibi defense, and we've already seen them offer somewhat of that, saying that Dr. McNeil was at work when this happened. And they're contesting, again, that a homicide even took place. So I think it's, you know, we're still halfway through this. You know, if this were a ball game, I think we're in the fifth inning. So, you know, we're not quite there yet. And again, you know, as much as I think everybody tries to formulate opinions in one way or the other, I think it's going to be interesting to see what the defense does. And, you know, what I, as much as everybody else, I'm going to be very curious to see what the jury decides and, you know, their rationale for that decision, why they made the decision they did, what was the piece of evidence or what wasn't the piece of evidence that made them render that verdict.
And let's talk about the jury. I found the jury makeup fascinating. You had a woman, middle-aged, dressed, you know, very conservatively, all the way down to somebody who looked like he was imitating Kid Rock. I mean, and this is Provo, Utah, a very conservative. I mean,
this was
it's
by design for the choice of the jury, though. This is, if you look at some of the jury questionnaires, I mean, there was questions asking potential jurors, what are your feelings about infidelity? What are your feelings about people who may grieve differently? I mean, a lot of these, this is, not to play stereotypes here, but this is a jury makeup that, you know, you want to have a jury of your peers. Well, this isn't the stereotypical Utah County jury where they're all, you know, Mormon, middle class, you know, middle-aged, you know, white and everything like that. What you have is kind of a more broader spectrum of people from different backgrounds. To, you know, and that was, it appears to me, at least from reading the jury questionnaires, that was by design.
And I'm sure that was for the defense. And I think they've got it. I mean, you, like you said, you hate to judge just by appearance, but I kind of have a feeling the Kid Rock kid is going to be a little more laid back about things than the woman that Kathy from CourtChatter.com describes as a teacher wanting to bring the ruler back. Kathy, what are your feelings on the jury?
I'll tell you, I'm with Ben. It is the strangest make. It's not stereotypical Utah County by far. There are those. There's the three guys who I call the return missionaries, and they have that look. But then we've got our two hippies. And so we've got the long-haired Kid Rock guy, and then we have the other guy who's older, long hair. He has seen some real fun days in his past, I would imagine. He is actually my favorite juror, and it's, and the reason is he doesn't look like, and I'm totally stereotyping, he doesn't look like he would care about any of this. If you just looked at him and glanced at him, you would think he doesn't care about this courtroom, he doesn't want to be here, and he's the opposite. He's the note taker. He's the one leaning in. He's the one motioning with his head in agreement or disagreement from time to time. He has surprised me the most out of all of them. About his attentiveness. So he's really into this. But there's a younger girl who I want to say is probably in her 20s, maybe late 20s, I don't know, it's hard to judge, and she just kind of plays with their hair. She sits on the back row. She doesn't take a ton of notes. It's an interesting makeup that we have the school teacher I talk about. She leans back in her chair and off to the side and takes a look at everyone like, you guys are all in trouble and you better just behave. And she doesn't hardly take a note at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's interesting. We have another young blonde girl on the front row. She's just very attentive and very into it. I always comment on her cute purses that she brings in because that's important to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a different makeup. And Ben is right. If you look at the jury questionnaire, they talk about things. And I found it interesting, Ben, when you just said, you know, it should be a jury of your peers. You know, who are Martin McNeil's peers? That man has a million sides to him.
Yeah,
right,
yeah,
exactly. I believe it that's very true because he has so many sides, so many personalities, so many lives that he led that I think they have a little of all. I think there's definitely, you can see some definite Mormons on the group. You can see some definite non-Mormons, and then you have old and you have young. So it's a mixture of people, and at the end there'll be eight of them. There'll be three alternates, but there'll be eight of them in there. And, oh, man, to be a fly on the wall. I have no idea what they're thinking. But my favorite part of every trial, and I've been doing this for years and years and years, my favorite part of every trial when it is loud is those jury questions.
Yeah.
They let you into the mind of a juror, and these guys are smart. These guys take away all the nonsense of a long, drawn-out testimony and get down to the heart of what they want to know. And it can just be one question, two questions, and that lets you kind of into their mind of how they're thinking. And they're kind of thinking, let's throw away the nonsense and let's get down to the heart of this.
What have the questions
there have been?
Some
fascinating questions. Oh,
yeah.
There have
Ben,
been
what have they been?
Absolutely.
What
questions? I can.
Do you have them handy?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I said, who has them handy?
I do. If you give me a few minutes, I'll pull them up.
Okay, but Ben,
yeah, there's been some fascinating ones. I mean, they've been as simple as, what was to Alexis Summers, what was Michelle McNeil's maiden name, which was Summers. That's something that Alexis mm-hmm. took her mother's maiden name. And there've been others where they have really cut through a lot of hours of prosecution, direct examination, just to cut through to a question that kind of everybody wanted to know and offered clarity. They've also, cut through a lot of the defense's cross-examination. It's just the questions from the jurors, and this is something that is allowed under Utah trial rules, obviously, but it's not frequently practiced. I've sat through a number of trials where jurors ask zero questions throughout
right.
the entire trial, and now we're, it really does offer that insight. It also kind of is a little telling of maybe which witnesses they consider more important, because it's ones that they have follow-up questions. Other ones, you just watch them, they have no questions. They're passing the witness just like the state and the defense is.
Right.
Okay, so let me give you an example, Tricia.
Okay.
Alexis was on the stand for a long time. She went over part of 2 days on the stand, and their only questions to her were what Ben just said, what was your mom's maiden name? Second, do you know who appointed you as the executor to the will? And she said, my dad. What time was the phone call from your dad about your mother not breathing in the bathtub? Did you leave on April 10th thinking your parents were leaving on a cruise that Sunday? Which that's another thing we can talk about in a minute. And then the last one was the defendant present when Michelle said she didn't want him to give her any more medication? So that was it. That was their five questions after hours and hours of testimony. They just want to get down to the heart of, can we say that he did this or not?
That is fantastic. Michael, what's your question?
I was curious to hear what Ben and Kathy thought of Rachel. I was able to watch most of that testimony, and she was an emotional wreck. And how did that play to the jury? Were they sympathetic, or was that a big fail for the prosecution? I'm just wondering how that read in the court.
Let's tell everybody who Rachel is. Ben, tell us who Rachel is.
Rachel is Martin McNeil's oldest daughter, and
okay.
she testified. It was extremely emotional. At one point, the judge had to halt proceedings so that she could compose herself. It was really bad, and she was very emotional on the stand. At times, she was visibly shaking, crying. She was whimpering sometimes in some of the answers. It's tough to say how that played to the jury. Of course, we're just going to have to ask them afterward. But it was, watching the testimony, she was providing some powerful testimony for the prosecution, and then the cross-examination began. And, the defense, I think, did a pretty good job of cross-examining her and, kind of pointing out some inconsistencies in a lot of the statements. And again, speaking to that reasonable doubt and maybe offering an alternative explanation to, what the state has alleged has happened.
Kathy, your thoughts on Rachel?
Okay. See, Ben's a professional journalist and has to report things sort of
yes.
unbiased. I'm a courtroom blogger, so I'll just tell you what I think. And
yes.
she was a mess, and I believe
yeah.
that she was medicated. And if she wasn't medicated, she sure came off as if she was heavily medicated. I watched her. It's different because I'm in the courtroom, and I'm usually on the back row. And so I came home and watched just a little bit of her on YouTube that night to get close-up of her face. And she was all over the place, and I don't think
yeah,
she did a great
was.
Job at all. I think that she did not – I don't think she helped. I think she was awash to both sides by the end. She
mm-hmm.
was combative with the defense, which I understand why she was, but she wouldn't answer very simple questions, and she would have just looked so much better had she done that. She really was just all over the place in her testimony.
That was kind of my reaction to her, too, Kathy. Fully, I felt sympathetic, obviously, but it was almost just too much. It was like,
right.
this is a terrible witness. We shouldn't have had her on.
Yeah, that was sad.
My end up feeling. Yeah, very
well,
sad.
Well, let me just
sad.
Say that because we know the state has a weak case compared to some other cases, I think they have to put everyone up, everyone they can. And so I understand why they did. And she's a daughter, and she had some information, especially about going to the temple and praying about a nanny. And then Martin had it all set up for Gypsy to be there in the parking lot. She had some information that needed to get out there. So I know why they did it, and I think she was more, and Ben can speak to this, but from what I've seen clips of, she was more put together during the pretrial hearing. So I'm not sure they thought she was going to be so all over the place during the actual trial.
Right.
The trials are emotional. I mean, these aren't things where people, you know, you really don't know how anybody's going to act until they get in that room, and it is a pressure cooker of a room. I mean, it is the whole of human emotion trapped in one location, and you know, it's difficult, especially when you have someone who is standing or sitting there on the witness stand testifying against their own father and accusing him, essentially, of murder.
Don't
that
you guys think it's really problematic that the drawing, the rendering that young Ada did of her mother, how she was positioned in the tub, versus the story that McNeil was telling everyone about her being bent over the tub? Isn't that powerful, just the fact that those stories are so incongruent? It seems to me, you know, the picture Ada drew had her mother with her head down at the faucet end of a tub. No one I know takes a bath that way.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Martin's story was so completely different than that. I think that's a big problem. That right there would lead me towards a guilty verdict personally, but I don't know.
What do you think, Ben?
Well, but the issue is was that drawing tainted? And the judge's ruling is that it was, that that's why it was not allowed in, is because Alexis drew pretty much everything that said, show me where mom is or where mom was. And the judge in his, you know, rulings, and one thing to the judge's credit is when he issues a ruling, he gives a very well, very detailed explanation of his rulings and why he's making this particular ruling. You could argue that's probably because of appeals down the road, but, mm-hmm. you know, he's at least making a thorough record of it. And his argument was, is with a lot of, you know, the testimony, why there was no testimony of Ada McNeil is because that it may have been tainted by her siblings, so much so that it, you know, unfairly, you know, prejudices against the defendant, who, you know, is innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Right. Kathy, what are your thoughts?
I don't know. It's a hard case. The drawing, the whole Ada thing, Ada, I saw, by the time I saw the video interview of her, I realized the defense was really spot on about not wanting, about thinking that she's so tainted. She was just, I watched this girl at the time of the interview was 7, so she was a year and a half older than when she mm-hmm. found her mom when she's being interviewed. And even then, I have a 7-year-old. She was just this little girl. There's no way that she has this spot-on memory. I agreed with the defense that she's been living with Alexis, who has been on a mission to convict her father. Mm-hmm. And there's no way that she's not tainted through all that. And so she didn't have everything right. And so the drawing, yeah, I don't know what hurt necessarily as much as I don't think she helped. Now, what I did like about Ada's interview that they played is she would not talk about her father.
Mm-hmm.
And so they finally got her to talk about, and they said something about her mom, and she said she was nice and she was pretty and whatever. And then, you want to tell me about your dad? I don't want to talk about it. Anything
right.
they ask about him, she'd say in a little whisper of a voice, I don't want to talk about it. And
yeah.
so I thought that may help the state a little bit as to, you know, out of mouths of babes.
Well, there
right.
you go. Exactly. Now, coming up on Tuesday, the court is not in session on Monday because of Veterans Day. So Tuesday, the inmates are going to come on and give their testimony. And we do have a question from our chat room. Let me get to it here. Where did it go?
It was, do we know what they're going to testify to?
Well, do they know what they're going to testify to, and how good is it really for an inmate to testify? Because it just seems there's always a good reason for an inmate to lie. And I'm assuming they got something for it, or maybe they didn't. I don't know. Ben, I'll take your thoughts on the inmate's testimony coming up.
This is the blessing and the curse of inmate witnesses. I mean, it's, you know, if you're going to snitch, you're going to get something out of it, and there's certainly that. These inmates are expected to testify that Martin McNeil essentially made a jailhouse confession to killing his wife, which is why the prosecution wants their testimony. The downside of it is they're inmate witnesses, so their credibility isn't exactly, shall we say, you know, the highest here. So it's going to be interesting to see the cross-examination by the defense on this and how they go about pointing out that these guys are, you know, are they fabricating this? Are they making it up? Are they out for revenge for some perceived slight against Martin McNeil while in jail? Who knows what's going to happen? I mean, this is definitely going to be testimony that is going to, you know, really, it'll either really help the prosecution's case or it'll really, you know, break them, because they're kind of ending on this high note with these four witnesses one after another. It's interesting to note that also, with these particular inmates, there is a safety concern about them. The judge has forbidden any photography of these inmates.
The judge
has also forbidden any mention of their names, because there's concerns that snitches get stitches and that they are in danger. Uh-huh. In fact, there was discussion outside the presence of the jury in court about how the judge was going to do this. He had to actually, you know, sleep on it to make a ruling on how he was going to go about doing this, because, you know, this is a televised trial. There's a still photographer in court. You know, reporters, we're all taking notes. You know, Kathy's blogging away. And, you know, it's like, how are you going to protect them? Well, this speaks to also the decorum order, where, you know, it's the same thing with Ada McNeil. If she were to take the stand, there was to be no photography of her at all on the courthouse premises whatsoever. So, you know, this is kind of an interesting situation that's going to happen, and basically what the judge has ordered is they will be referred to as Inmate 1, Inmate 2, Inmate 3, and Inmate 4. So, you know, it's
going
to be very interesting to see their testimony.
Ben, do you know if they've been promised anything, if they got anything for this, and don't they have to reveal that?
You know, they will have to. If they have been promised something, you know, it's part of disclosure for the court. Gypsy Willis, it was the same thing. When she took the witness stand, the prosecution right off the bat said, you know, you were offered a plea deal in exchange for your testimony, correct? And she said, yes, that is correct. So, you know, if they have been made promises, and I can't recall off the top of my head if there were plea deals or if there was anything. I mean, these are already, you know, inmate witnesses, so it may just be you don't have to comply, or, you know, maybe you've been offered a reduction in sentence down the road or something. That will be disclosed in court if that's the case.
Okay. And, Kathy, what are your thoughts on it?
About the inmates?
Yes.
You know, let me just, and this is a little plug, but I have a reason for it. I watched trials live streaming on a site called whoopwhoop.tv.
Uh-huh.
And we watched trials there, and then we live chat. And so they were asking, someone just barely asked on there, how can any inmate be found credible? And I have seen inmates testify. And you can see some that are not credible, that are just not believable. But then I think more times than not, I have believed the inmates.
Really?
And it really does depend. It really does depend on what kind of deal they're getting, and that's why that needs to be disclosed.
Mm-hmm.
Because you need to know what is the reason behind this. But it depends on what they have to say and how they say it.
Right.
But let me tell you this: this was brought up, and this wasn't a deal for them on the front end. It doesn't sound like, but it sounds like it could be a deal for them on the back end. The prosecutor, outside of the jury, told the judge that the inmates had been transferred to Utah and they're here waiting. However, there's big problems. They're worried about their identity, and Ben already spoke to how they're going to take care of that. They said they do not want to go back to the same prison in Texas. They're worried about their safety. They want to be transferred to a different prison.
Interesting.
That's something the defense could use if that's something that – but this wasn't a deal. It doesn't sound like it was a deal made up front to them. It's just been since they've gotten here, they've said, look, we're really worried about going back. The defense maybe could use that a little bit. Oh, they just wanted to be transferred to something easier. You know, I don't know.
Wow, that's very interesting. I wish I could be there in court, because that is going to be fascinating. So they have four inmates. Now, are these inmates, were they together when he made this supposed confession? Do you know, Ben?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. I know that there was some inmates who were incarcerated with him, and this may be statements made at different times. This may be all together. Off the top of my head, I'm just not entirely clear. I mean, of course, you know, one way to find out is we'll all find out on Tuesday.
Right.
It sounded like to me the prosecutor said something about inmates 2 and 3 were in one area and the others 1 and 4 were somewhere else, and I didn't know if it meant two different prisons and if he had gone originally to one prison and then he went to another. It sounded like to me it wouldn't be all four at the same time at the same place. He was in a federal prison in Texas for 3 years for fraud.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's going to lend a little more credibility if they weren't all together and if different times throughout the years he was talking about this.
That's very true. That will really help the prosecution's case if that is the case itself. Michael, you do have a question for. We're talking with Ben Winslow and from Fox 13 and Kathy from courtchatter.com. We're talking about the Martin McNeil trial happening in Provo, Utah. He is accused of killing his wife. And Michael, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I thought I was glad to hear Dr. Perper talk about the expulsion of water when the first responders finally arrived and started their compressions on Michelle. I'm wondering if it was as glaringly apparent, there was a question as to whether or not Martin was really doing his CPR. No one could testify. They saw the chest rising and falling. And she hadn't expelled any water. So obviously their efforts before the first responders got there were failing or flawed, I guess would be the best way to put it. But I think the expulsion of water obviously proves that she had inhaled a lot of water, thus drowning. Did you pick up on that as far as being in the court, and do you think it's something that was apparent to the jurors?
I think the earlier testimony from the Daniels speaks to more of the prosecution's claims of that if he was performing CPR, he was doing a crappy job of it. But it is interesting that Dr. Perper is the only one of the medical examiners who have looked at Michelle McNeil's case to say that she drowned. Others, obviously the two state medical examiners have said, heart problems, natural causes, undetermined. You know, we've had all these other diagnoses, and he's the only one to go that far and say drowning with the possibility of drug toxicity thrown in there. So, but as far as the issue of the CPR, I think that's why the prosecution put on the witness stand some of the neighbors and the police officers to testify about their efforts, what they saw, and whether or not Dr. McNeil really was performing CPR, whether he was just faking it.
Right.
Interesting. Kathy, your thoughts?
About what exactly?
She would have expelled water if they would have been doing it correctly.
Okay.
Right.
That
yes,
would have been the first thing that happens. But
right. My
happen
brain, my brain went all over the place after when Ben was talking. My brain went to all different kinds of areas. So
I just make her zone out. That's what she hears me talking and she just checks out.
Zones out. Checks out of reality.
No, I agree. That's big. And I'll tell you, somebody on that jury has some medical experience. Because they have asked a couple of really good questions, I thought, that I didn't think of at all, that was CPR related and that kind of thing. So I think somebody on there might have some insight to help the other jurors with that. Yeah, why would so much water be expelled once the professionals took over when the professional, I put in quotes, the doctor had already been performing it? So I think that speaks to a lot. I think they kind of proven that she didn't really expel much in the bathroom, and then it was when the professionals got there, they took her out just into the master bedroom right there so they had more room with her and working on her, and then it's like 3 and 4 cups worth come out.
Right.
To me, and I think Dr. Perper put that pretty clear, that's a lot of water.
Yeah.
That's a lot of liquid to come out, and how did that get in her?
Right.
To me, that speaks more to a struggle in inhaling water than pass out. I mean, if you pass out and go into water and you're unconscious, I don't know the medical part of that, but I don't know how much truly water you inhale in at the end. But it seems to me if you're in a struggle, you're inhaling more.
Well, exactly, and narcotics slow your respiration anyway. So if she was in such a stupor That's what often causes overdose deaths, is it suppresses the breathing mechanism, and that's what's breathing, and they die of lack of oxygen from an overdose. That's usually what happens. So I agree completely. She wouldn't have inhaled that much water if, indeed, she was in a drug-induced stupor.
Right. Absolutely. And also, what I find interesting is that Dr. Perper was the only expert who brought this up. Like you mentioned, Ben, the other medical examiners never seemed to find this. And that I find that troubling, not because Dr. Perper brought it up.
Well, it also speaks to the defense's claims that, you know, this isn't a homicide. I mean, it really,
right.
You know, and it's interesting to point out that not one of the medical examiners has been able to call the death a homicide. They've all said it's undetermined. Even Dr. Perper on the witness stand on Friday said undetermined, finally acknowledged after cross-examination. None of them will go so far as to declare Michelle McNeil's death a homicide, and that's what makes it such a tricky prosecution.
Very tricky.
Right.
Now,
well, but if you look at the facts of this case, you can't, the facts, which the medical examiners are, you can't call it a homicide. You don't have any struggle, any marks on her, any, you know, so any real obvious signs like that. So I can see how even Dr. Perper, who believes she was drowned, still couldn't say it was a homicide.
But it was really interesting that the prosecution, and we did a story on this the other night on Fox 13, which was that the prosecution kind of revealed a little bit more about their theory of what happened with Michelle McNeil, or what they believe happened with Michelle McNeil,
right.
When they said that they raised the hypothetical, and I think this speaks to the inmate witnesses, what we may hear from them, what they're going to claim that Martin McNeil said, which is that she was drugged, coerced into the tub, and then held down.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's what they're going to go for. You're right. That's exactly it. Let's talk about this. First of all, Ashton in California corrected me on Dr. Perper's head. I think this is important. Dr. Perper has a very unusually shaped head, and he has stated that his aunt had actually dropped him on his head, and it caused a blood clot, which caused extra bone to form on the left side of his head, and he has a sense of humor about it. He tells people that he had such a big brain, his skull couldn't hold it all in. So thank you, Ashton in California, for correcting me on that. Let's talk about this cruise. You said we needed to talk about it. Were they supposed to go on a cruise the next day? What was going on? Kathy from courtchatter.com, what's the deal?
Yeah, so that's the whole thing. As far as we know, no cruise was booked or scheduled, but at the post-op appointment, the day before her death, when Alexis was still there, Alexis went with both her parents to her mother's post-op appointment, and Martin McNeil asked the doctor if Michelle was well enough to go on a cruise on Sunday. And that would have been if maybe, I don't know, 3-4 days. I don't know the days of the week exactly, 3-4 days after this appointment. And Alexis thought that was odd because that's the first time she'd ever heard about a cruise.
Right.
And so I thought that was interesting. The jury picked up on that and said, when you went back to Nevada, did you think your parents were leaving on a cruise? And she said no. And I've seen some chat out there about that, about how maybe at one point he thought, take her on a cruise, accidental something, you know, maybe he had some ideas going there, but I just thought that was an interesting little tidbit that kind of came out that it was kind of out of left field. Like, what do you mean? Could she go on a cruise on Sunday?
Right.
Yeah, that's
right.
The first I've heard.
She never made it to Sunday. She never lived to Sunday.
Ben,
so
what are your thoughts?
It's just, you know, what Kathy said, it is an interesting little, you know, kind of, you wonder if, and this was, of course, what the jury's going to have to decide, if that was something that he tossed up as a, you know, if that really was a plan, that really was his, you know, goal, is to just kind of surprise her with this and go on the cruise so that she could recover in peace, or if this was just, you know, a last-minute excuse to kind of make an explanation for, you know, what happened or what may have happened.
Mm-hmm. Do we know if Michelle McNeil had started to see through her husband? I mean, obviously, he had been arrested, I think, right before or right after they were married. Have any of her friends said Michelle wanted a divorce? She knew what was going on. He was having an affair. Kathy from courtchatter.com, any of that come out yet? Even if it's not in trial, just in general.
Well, she did know something was up for sure, and she died April 11th. In March, she asked Alexis to help her look online and look at the phone records because she suspected him of having an affair, and that's how Alexis discovered Gypsy.
Mm-hmm.
So
oh.
And Alexis testified that in that week she was home from Michelle to take care of her mom from the surgery, she overheard her parents fighting in the bedroom about Gypsy because Michelle had had Alexis get all of the phone calls to that phone number. Alexis had mm-hmm. called the phone number. A lady answered. Alexis then went online to one of these services you can pay to find out who's registered to that phone number, and they found it was Gypsy Jillian Willis. So Michelle had the name. So this mm-hmm. is a fight a day or two before her death where she tells Alexis testified that Michelle told Martin, I want to see the phone records. I want to know what's going on, and I am not going to let this die. And then she's dead right after that.
And right after that. Ben, have you heard anything along those lines? Or is it basically
than what Kathy said in court, what was testified to is, and of course that's what the scope of the jury is going to hear, although Anna Walthall's testimony certainly resonated with the jury as well about, her affair and about the, as she said, pillow talk, where Martin McNeil had made comments to her that he knew how to induce a heart attack to make it look undetectable.
Interesting. We do have a couple of phone calls. We'll go to those phone calls, and we'll go to Michael. This one is from Utah, area code 435. Utah, you're on the line with Ben Winslow and Kathy from CourtCheddar.com, Michael in Michigan, and yours truly, Tricia. What is your question? Hello.
Hi, Michigan.
Oh, did I say Michigan again? I'm sorry. Minnesota. I'm sorry. I don't know why I do that. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Utah, you're on the air live.
Okay. Can you hear me?
We can hear you just fine.
Okay. My question is to Kathy about the twists and turns in the case that from the past, and I wanted to know if she thinks that Martin is killed before.
Yes.
Well, that certainly has been put out there. So Anna Walthall, the other mistress that testified, said that during pillow talk, she called it, Martin told her that he had killed his brother and made it look like a suicide. By the way, that ended up being a bathtub accident and that his brother really did die that way. He said that when he was 8 years old, he tried to kill his mother and that his mother was an alcoholic and he had taken a bunch of pills around the house and put them in her drink. And she'd passed out, but his sister found her and called 911. This is all coming from the mistress. This is something that's interesting, and I don't know how far an investigation will go with this, but she also just didn't. Now, these things did not come out in court, okay? She wasn't allowed to talk about these things, but this is what she has previously testified to in pretrial, that the hospital he worked at is the Utah State Developmental Center. The patients there are all mentally handicapped. They have mm-hmm. some kind of mental disability. And she says he told her that he has killed people there by giving them whatever, drugs. And so she says he's a serial killer. Now, of course, she's got mental health problems, and so there's a lot more to that, a little bit more to that. It's a multiple personality disorder. But the daughters and Michelle's sister really wants that looked into about patients at the Utah Developmental Center and the deaths while he was the medical director there. So that's just something interesting. None of this has been proven. I don't think any of it's going to be able to be proven. But do I personally think he's killed somebody before? I think that it's a possibility, only because I think he's kind of a sociopath that way. So I think that there could be a possibility of that. I wouldn't want to be around him if he is found not guilty. I don't think he has the conscience.
Yes.
Go ahead. Kathy, again, do you think at this point that there needs to be a federal investigation on him?
I don't know. I don't know. Ben may know a little bit more about if anything's going to come up of that. I've just read a little bit about that on Michelle's sister's website. They're talking about the other patients at the center, and they had brought it to that director or whoever is in charge there's attention. I don't know how far that's going.
Okay, let's go to Washington State, area code 206. Washington State, do you have a question for our guest tonight?
Hi, Tricia. This
Hi.
Is Dan.
Hi.
Hi,
how are
Ben.
You?
Hi, Kathy. I'm good, thank you.
Good.
Hi, Michael.
Good.
This is a great, great conversation going on here. I really
thank
enjoy
you.
This. And
thank you
I
so
wanted
much.
To take it back. You bet. I wanted to take it back just a little bit
sure.
regarding Harper and Rachel and the question about Martin himself of whether it's possible that he had done this. I had the same feeling or philosophy, I guess, or that Martin did ground her.
Mm-hmm.
He did do that to Michelle because it was something that the neighbor had said, the male that came over to help. He kept looking for something to wipe Michelle's face. There
mm-hmm.
was nothing in the bathroom to be able to do that. I found that peculiar. He then mentions that there were wet towels found on the floor in the bathroom. This was before they had ever taken Michelle. So
interesting.
I thought that was very good testimony because had she been struggling, even in the state that she was in, which I agree with Michael about the narcotics, it reduces your ability, you know, you're in a lower mobility type state, and she was
mm-hmm.
already at a disadvantage. So whatever fighting had taken place or struggle that she tried, there was had to have been water on the floor because that neighbor's wife also, the question was asked about water on the floor, had she seen it? And she said no, because she knew with the type of shoes she had on, she would have slipped in that.
Right.
So I thought that was really interesting. The other question, which I don't, maybe Kathy, you know, or Ben, if the question was brought up, what the distance was from the home to the school, and why Martin felt compelled to walk to the school to pick Ada up and walk.
I think that was an inconsistency actually in testimony. I think they later said that he had driven, he had picked her up in a car and driven her.
That's what I've read, right.
Uh-huh, and I heard that part too, so I was kind of confused, and I thought maybe the prosecution would rehabilitate that part because that gave me some pause regarding the lividity.
Mm-hmm.
And how
yeah, I think
right.
that was the issue was you're dealing with a child witness who's being interviewed at
right.
the Children's Justice Center, and I think they did clarify in later testimony that was she was driven home,
picked up at the school and driven home.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I thought that was somewhat confusing because something about going to McDonald's and all of that, but that's later on with the neighbor. But I thought that was interesting because of the question about the lividity.
Right.
That,
well, go ahead, Kathy.
Yeah, well, see, here's the thing. The prosecution's theory is that she was in that bathroom for, I don't know, an hour and a half or 2 hours before Ada and Martin came back in. You know, the last time he's seen at his work is 9:26, 9:30 a.m., something like that, and then back around at around 11 o'clock to hurry and get his award and then pick up Ada by, like, 11:30. So if he did do this, it was, like, in the 9:30, 10 a.m. range, and then 911's not called till like, 11:45 or something.
But how would that, oh, well, of course, I don't know. I think of things like studies at the body farm, you know, what is the body's capability of that much lividity when it's submerged in water? There's got to be still some kind of buoyancy, so there isn't any, you know, pooling of the
mm-hmm.
blood, per se. And I just thought that was really curious. Yeah, I see like Ben says about the, you know, maybe at the bottom of the fifth here, and I think that's great that the jurors can bring the questions forward and maybe work from those questions to, you know, set up their next approach and rehabilitating their own witness again.
Absolutely.
And maybe direct it in that fashion. And then just, Rachel, I felt so, I could barely listen to it. I couldn't watch her for a long periods of time. And I so agree with Michael. This was really disturbing. I do feel like she was heavily medicated because I've seen her in other, you know, on the other program deal and talking. She's completely lucid and mm-hmm. very candid, frank. So I didn't see that problem with her, but I think it's so disturbing that the vision that she had all those years of the father was suddenly shattered by this question.
Exactly.
What was going on?
Exactly, mm-hmm. and thank you. Thank you for calling in. We do have to move on because we're kind of running out of time here. But thank you.
Yes.
You're such a sweetheart
thank
for
you.
Calling in. And call in again, okay? Okay,
okay
bye-bye.
Honey. Bye-bye.
Michael, in Minnesota, you have a question.
Yes, darling. Now, again, back to Kathy and your blog. I read where you think that it's very possible that the state will rest after Tuesday if they can get all those witnesses in on Tuesday. If not Tuesday, then certainly Wednesday. Has anyone seen the witness list for the defense? And truthfully, in full disclosure, I've talked to Tricia, and I wondered about the possibility of the defense saying something to the effect of, what am I hearing?
Sorry.
I don't know.
My plug came out of my laptop.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Anyway, is there any possibility that the defense will take the tactic that we don't believe the state has proven their case, therefore we rest as well? Or
that's
do
interesting.
They have an extensive witness list? And what are we anticipating from the defense, I guess, is my question.
Okay, so Ben may be more in the know because I do not and have not been able yet to get the defense witness list, so I'm not sure that it's been released. What I know is they have an expert, Dr. Lee, Matthew Lee, not Henry Lee, like some have thought. Dr.
Oh
Matthew Lee.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You mentioned Henry Lee, and everybody suddenly got really excited.
Matthew Lee, I think he's from Virginia or something, to rebut the medical examiner's testimony. So that's the only one I know of for sure. Ben may know more about that.
I believe there is a couple of medical experts, Dr. Lee being one of them, that they anticipate calling. But when I spoke with the defense last week, they were still evaluating who they're going to call, if they have any rebuttal witnesses, you know, to maybe challenge some of the testimony that's been made here, you know, by witnesses for the state, you know, people who with direct knowledge of some of these conversations that have taken place either at the Utah State Developmental Center or, you know, it's family conversations, those types of things. But I know at least a couple of witnesses, possibly expert witnesses for the defense, including Dr. Lee. And again, it's being evaluated on a daily basis as you go through trial. It's just the mechanics of trial. The state has not even called as many as they had put on their own witness list. But I also, you know, the big X factor here is, will Dr. McNeil take the stand in his own defense? And I keep asking that. I keep getting a big, fat no comment.
Yeah.
No.
I can't.
No,
there's
no
way.
And no.
No way. Ben, real quickly, about what Michael and I have talked about. It's a long shot, but can't the defense stand up and say, you haven't proven your case, therefore we don't need to call anybody?
They do it at every trial. Every trial I've sat through.
Oh, they do?
Midway through,
okay.
When the defense begins, they motion for a mistrial. Pretty mm-hmm. much every single time I've sat through a trial, with one exception, the judge has basically said, motion denied, and they move on. Trial continues. Mm-hmm. That's not entirely unexpected. So, you know, that they expect that to happen. You know, this one is going to be very interesting. Again, they're contesting that no homicide took place. So, mm-hmm. you know, really going to be interesting to see where this goes and what the defense, you know, brings forward. And I expect that that'll probably begin Wednesday or Thursday.
That is going to be interesting. Well, as you can tell, I'm losing my voice. And Ben, I know you have to go. And Kathy, I know you're going to have munchkins climbing all over you here shortly. So how about if we go around the table here? And I don't know if Patrice is still with us. If she is, I will go to her. And Vicky's going to come on next week. Veal Pate will be on next week for us, but I'm losing my voice. So Ben, final thoughts on the Martin McNeil case and what's going on and your thoughts in general.
Well, I think that at this point, again, it is still anyone's game. It is still up in the air. This is, from the prosecution, as I've said before, it is admittedly not a slam dunk case. But the defense also has a difficult, road ahead of them as well. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. I'm going to put in a plug for our station. I mean, we'll be covering it every day, and we have been live streaming all of the proceedings when court is in session on Fox13Now.com.
Fox13Now.com. Great, great station, great channel, great reporters. Ben, thank you very much. Kathy, from CourtChatter.com, your final thoughts.
It's a hard case. Here's what I know about juries. You can never predict them. So I have been surprised on many cases about what a jury will do and what they think. Mm-hmm. I think if they go strictly by the book, they probably have to find him not guilty. But I also know that juries bring in common sense into the jury room, and that's why we don't know. I don't know how this will go. This one is really up in the air, which is why it took years and years to even charge him. I think the prosecution has had a weak case. What we didn't get a chance to talk about, and there's no time, is the different attorneys and their personalities in this case. But
go ahead and touch on that, can't you, Trish?
Oh, if you have time, absolutely. Do you have time?
Sure, I do.
Okay, go for it.
I just want to talk a little bit about them, because for a lot of the avid, what I call trial junkies out there that watch these things, they just came off the heels of the Jody Arias case with Juan Martinez, the prosecutor, who
was
a total, what they call a pit bull or bulldog or something. And then, and the attorneys on the other side, Arias' attorneys, everybody had big personalities. Everybody went at each other. It was very contentious in that courtroom. That all makes for good trial watching, okay? So good TV watching. And so these attorneys have gotten a hit in the social media. Boring. I've heard quotes, that Provo must be the library capital of the world. They're very kind to each other. So I did a little research on each one of the attorneys, and on my blog you can find it. It's just under, I think it's the players of the McNeil case, and I've done a little write-up on them. The interesting thing is two of the three prosecutors and the defense attorney Spencer, they all went to BYU Law School.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all BYU alums, which more likely than not makes them all Mormons. They all have sort of that connection. None of them, nobody on either side has great big personalities. And so they're just kind of going through the motions, trying their case like professionals, and I think people want to see more out of them. I don't know that that makes a huge difference to a jury. I think it does to us that watch it.
I want to see some passion and conviction and fire.
Yeah, exactly. So let me tell you what I did, because I'm just, naughty and do whatever I want in the courtroom, apparently. So Prosecutor Chad Grunander had come off of arguing a point outside the jury, and he'd come back to the back row where I was, and he was talking to somebody that he knew there, and he was mad. And it was when the defense was trying to get Dr. Perper's testimony thrown out. And the judge took a long break, like well over an hour, to make that decision the other morning. And so he came back, and he was telling the guy, and he was mad, and his face was red, and he used a curse word. And so I, just being me, pop up, and I say, you know what? Social media would love for you to bring that passion to the front of the jury.
There you go.
And he said, and I'm pretty sure I offended him, so later I talked to him, but he said, Okay, well, what they need to realize is this is our case in chief. This is not cross-exam. There isn't a lot I've had to go at yet. Wait for cross-examination. So that was his quote to me, wait for cross-examination. Then I found him later on in the hallway, and I said, I hope I didn't offend you. I didn't mean to come off like that. I think you're doing a great job. And I explained mm-hmm. to him, these people have just come off of Juan Martinez. And so, and he said,
right.
No, you didn't. You didn't. But that's their thing. They're the nicest people in the world. So the investigator, Jeff Robinson, who is in the courtroom, he brings in and out the witnesses. He's already been on the stand once. He's super nice guy. We had a big long chat in the parking lot the other day. And just like these people are just nice people. And so it doesn't translate to good court TV, I think.
Right, right.
So true.
That is the truth. And that's, yeah.
But let me tell you a little bit about Jared Perkins as the dark-headed prosecutor, taller. He such a smart guy. He went to Cambridge over in England, and he has a master's degree in philosophy.
Wow.
And then he finally went to law school. But he also, all of these guys except one, I think, served missions for the LDS Church.
Mm-hmm.
So they all have this kind of same, kind of nice guy mentality.
Well,
so
kind of
from what I
demeanor. Their demeanor is kind of the same, just kind of mellow, laid back, very nice, mm-hmm. very gentle mm-hmm. almost.
They're nice to each other in the hallways, the defense attorneys and the prosecutors. They open the door
mm-hmm.
for each other coming into the courtroom. I mean, it's just not what we're used to seeing. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, like this is the first live broadcast ever in a Utah courtroom. And so the trial watchers of the world haven't had a taste of what Utahns are like. And I kind of think this is a stereotypical Utah.
Absolutely.
It's kind of nice. It's kind of, you know, Utah Valley is called Happy Valley. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's just kind of nice people. And I think they're getting a hard hit. And if I was just like everyone else watching it, I would be probably getting on them too. But because I've been there, talked to them, see them, know a little, I kind of want to defend them. Because I think they're very
right.
smart men and women
right.
on both sides. They just have different personalities than we've used to be seeing.
And you're absolutely right. They are, and I don't mean this in a negative way at all, but I want to say they're just typical people from Provo. That's just
mm-hmm.
how they're very kind and gentle, and you're not going to see fireworks like Juan Martinez ever, ever.
Right.
But it'll be interesting to see how lawyers, too, now in Utah will react, and will they start playing to the camera. Ben, I know you're still
mm-hmm.
with us. Would you like to comment on this, too?
If they are playing to the camera, they're playing to the wrong audience. I mean, you are playing to you as an attorney. You have to play to the judge and to the jury. If you are
right.
trying to play to a camera, you're losing your case right away.
Ooh, that's true. Very good point. I don't think these guys are playing to the camera at all. Like I said, it'll be interesting.
I can assure you they are
yeah.
not.
Yeah, they can definitely are not. So anyway,
maybe the cameras are intimidating to them.
Oh, that could be.
You know, there's been a lot of resistance to cameras in the courtroom here. I mean, I sit on a subcommittee with the State Office of the Courts to discuss, you know, some of these issues. And, you know, there was a lot of concern, a lot of reluctance when this was put in. And this really is the first live broadcast trial we have seen. So this is going to be studied for trials to come as far as what works and what didn't work. When this is all said and done. But, you know, this is all new. We're all in a brave new world here with cameras in the courtroom. I mean, in a lot of states, this is old hat. This is nothing new. You know, for us, we're all just trying to figure out how it's going to work and how it all is working.
Right, exactly. And I'm very glad that it's finally happened. Utah's coming into the 21st century at social media. And it's,
oh, it
you
is
know,
fantastic.
The,
I mean, because you can,
it.
With restrictions, as you guys found out with the picture, there
mm-hmm.
are some restrictions.
Yes.
But, you know, what the great thing about this is you know, the internal studies from the judiciary, the State Office of the Courts, is that 80% of the news about the judiciary comes from the news media.
Mm-hmm.
All the information people get about what happens in the courts comes from the news media. So, you know, or a significant portion, I should say. But, you know, so what this does is it kind of opens up and explains the process. It shows them unfiltered how this happens. You know, we get to see how it all comes together, why they ask the questions they ask, why, you know, certain things are allowed into evidence, why certain things are excluded from evidence. You know, mm-hmm. it's a great way to inform the public. And, I mean, of course, you know, I'm going to side with cameras in the courtroom here because, you know, I work for a television station. But
right.
this is also just great in terms of informing the public about the judicial system and why it is so important and, you know, really contributing to an open and free, you know, court system.
I think it's the best thing that you can
never. I'll never understand why criminals have so many more rights than the poor innocent victims when it comes to these
because
trials.
Because the system was never set up for the victim. It's about getting justice for the state. It's about exacting that. Victims' rights is a concept that is still relatively new when you consider the length of the judicial history of the judicial system.
It's wrong, though, to me. So wrong.
You know what, Michael? I understand that, and I feel that way, too, and I feel that, you know, a great example is being able to just drag Travis Alexander through the mud.
There you go. That's
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
And I get all that, and Ben's right. Things are starting to change a little bit. Now they have victims' advocates that they allow, you know, a representative in the courtroom now, even if they're on the witness list. There's some things that are happening, but my take on it is we have to give them all, we need to give the defendants all these rights because we never want to put an innocent person behind bars. Can you think of anything more horrible than that? I mean, really more horrible than being
right.
completely innocent of a crime in people anyway. So it leans in the favor of the defendant. You know, you're innocent until proven guilty, so they do get the rights. That's what it's about, you know. As far as the law is concerned, that's an innocent person sitting in that courtroom, and that state better prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they're not innocent because
mm-hmm.
we don't want innocent people
understand
to
all
guard.
That. I understand all that. But past criminal activity, why that can't be brought in. I mean, if a person, if I ever, God forbid, were to go on trial, there's nothing in my past that I'm ashamed of, and I would hope they could bring it up because there's nothing there because I'm not
a
criminal.
Have you ever been convicted of any kind of a crime?
DUI.
Okay.
In 1980-something.
So would you like that brought up as, you know, prior bad acts showing that you are a bad person from here on out, from time until eternity, because you did that once?
Well, I think once it's said that it was 40 years ago, I think I'd be pretty okay. Or 30 years ago, I think I'd, you know, I don't know that anyone would hold that against me.
But should it be held
not.
Against you? Should they be allowed to bring that into court and show that you are a horrible person and you should be put in prison for time and all eternity, or maybe even, you know, put to death because you had that also? That speaks to what kind of a horrible person you are.
Well, but listen, I agree with Michael to some extent. I think it's a fine line. I think
it's a fine line, yeah.
And a judge does allow prior bad acts in when it meets the legal criteria for it. So it's not always
exactly.
that their background's never allowed in. It's a fine line. So I get what both Michael and Ben are saying here. You don't want the jury to convict the guy because he was horrible, because he was an alcoholic and had 3 DUIs, but that has nothing to do with whatever he's on. You know, because juries can get things in their minds, and so the judge has to walk a fine line. Is it more probative than prejudicial against them? And it is a fine line. And I agree.
And we've seen it played out.
Yeah.
The things in this trial the judge has allowed in and things that he has not allowed in. It's you know, Kathy is exactly right. This is why they make the decisions that they do, is mm-hmm. you know, and what the jury sees and what they don't see.
Well,
now,
we
are
could
the
do
McNeil daughters in court every day, or are they not?
No, they were not allowed in.
They
weren't allowed in when they were on the witness list, and then even though being taken off, being released from subpoena, they have not been back in. Just Michelle's sisters and her niece are in there every day.
And Kathy, that's who was sitting there when Pink Patrice and I were there, correct? I was
yes,
trying to figure out who that was. Yeah, oh, they're darling. They're just beautiful women, very and so sweet. Okay, Michael, and we've heard from Ben and Kathy. Michael, I'm going to give you the last word on the case
of
Martin
McNeil.
Well, I
wondered, are Michelle McNeil's parents there?
I don't know.
Are
they
still alive?
That's what I don't – Ben, do you know?
I don't believe they're even still alive. I'm not sure,
I don't
though.
Think they are either.
Yeah, I've never read anything about them, so I don't know. All right,
how
well, thank you both.
How about I research that for you, Michael?
Oh, I would love it. I'm glued to you. You are now on my bookmarks, and I go to you, and I will continue to do so. CourtChatter.com, everyone. It is the best. If you don't have time to sit and watch an entire trial, it's the next best thing to doing that.
Absolutely.
So I thank you. And, Ben, I haven't watched your coverage, being in Minnesota, not Michigan. But
we have the internet, fox13now.com.
I will be checking you out, and I thank you so much. And it was a great show. I thank you all so much.
Yes,
oh, absolutely, anytime.
And you better believe that, because I'll be calling you, Ben Winslow and Kathy. So, Ben Winslow, Fox 13, is it fox13now.com?
That is correct.
Fox13now.com and CourtChatter.com. Thank you both for joining us tonight. It was a fascinating show. And we'll do this again real soon, maybe even next week. So take care now. Bye-bye.
Thank
All right,
you,
take
Trisha.
Care.
Thank you.
Oh, Michael, I'm losing my voice. I won't be able to function.
I hear that. Oh, poor thing.
Well, listen, it was a great show. Thank you. And I don't know why I keep saying you're from Michigan. I have no idea. It's like Tourette's of the brain. It's just, I should just start jerking. And, you know, I mean, it's just every time your name comes up, I say Michigan, but it's Minnesota. I will remember that from now on. So thank you, Michael. Once again, you were a jewel to show up. You know, everybody knows the opinions expressed on this show are those of the hosts and guests, and it's not the responsibility of websleuths.com or forumsforjustice.org. Okay, that's all I can say in my disclaimer tonight. Good night, everybody. Michael, I'll be talking to you soon, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye, good night.
Good night, everyone.